Yale Podcast Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Yale Law Journal podcast. I'm Jenny Choi. I'm a first-year editor.
And I'm Lorraine. I'm a articles editor and the lead editor of the piece.
And we're this week's co-hosts. On this podcast, we'll be interviewing Yale Law Journal authors about their new and forthcoming work. Today, we're joined by Professor Joy Milligan, who will be talking about her insightful new article, Plessy Preserved, Agencies and the Effect of Constitution. In this work, Professor Milligan draws on original archival research to chart the history of an alternative administrative constitution that remains etched in American cities today through its preservation of Plessy's separate but equal approach in public housing. In her words, Plessy's resilience in the administrative realm underscores the ongoing need to unearth such regimes and to better assess agencies' role in establishing the constitutional principles that actually govern us. Her article will be published in Issue 4.
Joy Milligan is an assistant professor of law at Berkeley Law, where she teaches courses in civil procedure and anti-discrimination law. Professor Milligan's interdisciplinary scholarship considers the intersection of law and inequality, with a particular focus on race-based economic inequality. Before entering academia, Professor Milligan practiced civil rights law as a Skadden Fellow and clerked for Judge Tashima of the Ninth Circuit. She is a graduate of NYU Law School, where she was a Furman Scholar. So thank you so much, Professor Milligan, for joining us today. And, you know, in your article, you offer an account that's fascinating in both its historical narrative and present-day implications. So we'll be starting with the history, but first we just wanted to define some of your key terms so that we're all on the same page. You refer to the article's unearthing the administrative constitution in public housing. Can you kind of define that term for us and let our listeners know what that means?
Sure. And first off, thanks so much, Jenny and Lorraine, for hosting me here today. It's really fun to get to talk about this over the airwaves rather than just in print. So the administrative constitution is a sort of maybe a decade-old term that's emerged in legal scholarship as a way of thinking about the kind of previously perhaps known but not very remarked role of administrative agencies in fleshing out the meaning of the Constitution. So whether it's in applying kind of statutory regimes like, most relevant to my own work, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which embodies constitutional principles, agencies, in fact, have been kind of the frontline mechanism for figuring out what vague words like discrimination mean in practice. So that's one version of the administrative constitution, just the work that agencies have done in literally fleshing out constitutional principles by implementing statutory regimes. Here, it was a sort of another version of administrative constitutionalism and the administrative constitution that I focused on in this piece, which is not so much applying explicit constitutional principles that were explicitly imported into statutory regimes the way we see in the Civil Rights Act, but rather kind of reading background constitutional principles into existing statutory regimes or even kind of mediating conflicts over which constitutional principles to read into the background of the existing statutes.
So in your article, you know, the history is incredibly rich, and you describe how throughout the 1900s, the federal administrators in charge of public housing created a segregation-based legal regime that relied on Plessy, continuing even after Brown versus Board of Education, which is the case that rejected segregation. So how did this system come to be?
Yeah, I think that's the most interesting aspect of the story in some ways, and the one that's kind of least known and least commented upon because it's sort of counterintuitive. So in the 1930s, public housing kind of started to take shape as a series of experiments by the federal government in the course of the Depression as they sought ways to basically create jobs for out-of-work laborers in large part and to kind of resuscitate the housing industry, which was like a huge part of the economic slump. So building public housing became one of those ways to create jobs. And as they did so, it of course, because it was public public housing intended to serve the poor attracted people who are reformers, liberals of various stripes, from people who are kind of classic, like, slum reformers that focused on kind of tenement housing and improving housing conditions in cities, to people allied with labor unions and workers' rights who wanted, you know, decent housing for all workers. And among that group were a fair number of people who were racial liberals, as well as a few African Americans as well, who were kind of part of the New Deal. So there was a racial equity mandate for building public housing. There was also a racial equity mandate for who would get to live in public housing. So, and that's where the segregation aspect came into the forefront, because out of, you know, what was then referred to as sort of deference to local prerogatives, they would allow localities to choose to segregate this federally funded housing, but they called for it to be equal. That is, they asked localities to assess what proportion of the people who fell into the income guidelines would be African American at that local level, and that they assign, you know, that proportion to Black and white housing. So they thought of it as a safeguard for these kind of racial equality principles within the limits of kind of the Plessy world they lived in. And they were very proud of it. And if the Federal Housing Administration, which was sort of a counterpart agency to the Public Housing Administration, became sort of the villain of that era in terms of racial equality, because they backed through mortgage insurance the construction of kind of the massive suburban developments that kind of created the landscape outside of cities, and they allowed them, and indeed sort of advised that they be kept whites only. If that were the villain, the FHA was sort of who civil rights leaders attacked in that era, because of the outright exclusion from housing that they represented. The Public Housing Administration was seen as a friend. It employed substantial amounts of Black employees, even, you know, up to the highest reaches of the agency, and sort of took care to live up to this racial equity mandate. Yet it was all within the context of segregation.
Just following up on that, you've described how the early roots of the public housing agency were very progressive, and how the racial equity mandate was seen as, you know, a very positive thing in the eyes of African American leaders. But over time, this became entrenched, and one of your very insightful sentences in the article is that Plessy was a necessary political price to pay for housing the poor. Can you kind of describe more how liberal reformers used Plessy to kind of allay the conservative concerns about public housing?
Right. So if we think of sort of northern liberals as these sort of pivotal actors, they were kind of caught between a rock and a hard place in terms of advocating for public housing. They faced this choice because public housing came to be – it was controversial at the origins in the 30s, but seen as sort of, you know, a necessary component of economic recovery. And then because of the need to build war housing, it sort of took a backseat during World War II. Post-World War II, the political conflicts kind of flared up again. Economic conservatives came to the forefront again. And so there were these charges that, you know, public housing was socialism, you know, reemerged and were the basis for 1945 to 49 long-term struggle in Congress over what sort of a package of housing reforms should look like in the post-war era. And the key issue over which they struggled was what to do about public housing. So for liberal reformers with, you know, economic conservatives, often Republicans, sometimes some Southern Democrats, on the one hand opposing, you know, massive government spending to help the poor and the working class in the form of public housing, they needed other allies to be able to enact public housing as a long-term program. And so they, as with other reform programs, social investment programs of the era, they had to attract Southern Democrats. And the way to do that was to kind of give Southerners assurance that they would not kind of challenge the overall Jim Crow system, and that the federal role in this program wouldn't be used as kind of a sword to attack white supremacy governing principles that were in place, of course, not just in the South, but perhaps most flagrantly in the South. And Black organizations were split as well. Some thought that it was worth the cost to simply get the public housing that was desperately needed. by so many poor and working class families, and especially African American families. Some thought it was worth the price to just countenance segregation, right? But the NAACP and their allies were kind of the primary voice opposing that bargain for the reason that they saw that, you know, when you think about the built environment, it lasts a very long time. And they understood that segregation kind of in tandem with various patterns of land ownership would simply mean that, you know, black communities would never achieve equality, even, you know, a material kind of separate but equal equality within that framework. But in fact, they were ignored, and attempts to insert a non-discrimination, non-segregation provision into the housing statutes, particularly that key 1949 Housing Act, failed.
So it's clear that public housing was a challenging field for the federal government, both in terms of the world political atmosphere and kind of the permanent material nature of housing itself. In the article, you mentioned a couple other factors that make it this way. And one of them is that when it comes to housing, the federal government is kind of squeezed in between local governments and private industry. And you say that this made the Federal Housing Authority especially dependent on Congress and local governments. But of course, in your article, the story ends with the FHA ultimately being the kind of seemingly ultra-independent protector of, you know, this administrative constitution that entrenched segregated housing. So explain the story for us.
The government role in social provision from, you know, at least the 1930s on, really even earlier on, was kind of premised on a racial bargain about kind of the preferential access that poor and working class whites would get to these government benefits. And that seemed to be enough to stave off kind of the inherent kind of conservative thread in U.S. politics that fights against all such programs, especially centralized ones. But then in the era when racial inclusion began to become like a mandate that policymakers and political leaders at the national level started to take seriously, and of course we see it ensconced in decisions like Brown and in the 1960s civil rights statutes, that seems to sort of exacerbate the ongoing stigmatization and backlash against poverty programs. So I think part of how you have to understand it is that the PHA in some ways was a precursor to the ways in which racial enforcing non-discrimination and equal access to public assistance for all races led to kind of the further political denunciation of any form of government assistance. The Public Housing Administration is a precursor of all that, because by assuring that people of color would have a fair share of public housing, they started down a road upon which public housing would become gradually over time a majority-minority program and become thereby incredibly racially stigmatized. Whites would find public housing assistance through other means. You know, things like housing vouchers are still kind of the main source of public housing assistance for whites now. And so I think that part of the rock and the hard place was that the very commitment to racial equity, both ensconced and entrenched segregation in public housing, but it also heightened its sort of political vulnerability over time.
Over time, as the legal landscape surrounding segregation changed from the time of Plessy, you mentioned Shelley v. Kramer. You also wrote a lot about Buchanan v. Worley, which seemed to bar government-imposed residential segregation. And then finally, Brown, which explicitly overturned Plessy. How were government lawyers able to argue that these cases did not mean that the way the PHA was segregating housing needed to change?
I think it's a familiar dynamic to us as lawyers. It's just one that's harder to see in hindsight for a case like that's part of our canon, like Brown or Shelley before it. You know, law is malleable, and making judgment calls about which should be the governing legal framework for a particular area, especially in the pre-Brown era when it was the NAACP was arguing that Plessy didn't apply to housing at all, basing that argument on cases like Buchanan that you just mentioned, Lorraine. In that era, it was certainly a judgment call. So government lawyers could easily think of a case like Buchanan, which barred local segregation ordinances, which had started to take off in the early part of the 20th century. It prohibited that direct local action to segregate. But, you know, lawyers could easily distinguish direct legal mandates of segregation from kind of more opaque forms of government support for enforcement of segregation. So that sort of familiar distinction to us as lawyers between action and inaction, direct mandates versus sort of less overt forms of action. Those are the kinds of distinctions they made. Prost Brown, those same kinds of distinctions also sort of helped them kind of fight against the logic of Brown. That and the logic of federalism, right? Like, again, the baseline compromise, of course, of all these, you know, social programs that get enacted in the 20th century is that the federal government won't actually run them and direct them on the ground. They'll give various forms of assistance, grants and aid primarily to states and localities, or even, you know, other forms of financial support, even to private actors. So they won't do these things directly out of deference to state sovereignty, local authority. And by constructing them in that way, that too was a way to ward off, well, we as federal government aren't doing anything at all other than, you know, writing checks. Or I think I have a line in the article from the Hayward litigation in which they compare it, I think, to a bank that provides loans or something. You know, we're just sort of a financial intermediary here. We're not responsible for the policies that play out in these things. We write a check and walk away, which, of course, was the furthest from the truth in the way that all the, you know, public housing and all national social programs are constructed. But it's not at all surprising that lawyers would lawyer and do so in the context. And maybe I shouldn't laugh about it because, you know, it's hardly laughable what the consequences have been, but it is so predictable in the way that kind of legal training can lead us to kind of create predictable distinctions between sort of one line and the other of what's legal and what's not legal.
Hmm. And of course, listening to this, all kinds of light bulbs are going off about, you know, the present day implications of this story and the really timely kind of normative aspects of your work. So maybe we can transition a bit to talking about that. So you ask in the piece, you know, does this history caution against judicial deference to administrative interpretations of the Constitution? Do you think it should? And, you know, should courts give any deference to agencies' constitutional interpretations?
The real problem is that so much of agency interpretation around constitutional principles oscillates, and it's driven by kind of political shifts in who governs the executive branch. It can also be driven, which is in some ways the story of this piece of the public housing piece, is that it can be driven by the politics that are in place when the agency's created too. So it's this complicated mesh of various political actors and whoever was dominant both at the time the agency was created and whoever's dominant in kind of contemporaneous governance of the agency can exercise real pressure on the way that in which they'll interpret the Constitution, and for good and for ill, right? And so it's hard to back out of that recognition to kind of a universal theory of when we should like and not like agencies' constitutional interpretations. I think the difficulty in you see it in scholarship as people, everyone struggles with this, is it's very hard to extricate our political preferences, our legal preferences, our theory of how best to read the Constitution in a substantive way from what we think about agencies as institutions. So I think there's a good case to be made for some deference to agencies' constitutional interpretations, but I think it should be done with caution and not simply in light of kind of gerrymandered narrative about the progressive role agencies have played in particular instances. We kind of have to see the full sweep.
Another one of the takeaways from this project has been that there is this gap between formal law and then compliance with it. And do you see this more as a problem of enforcement or, you know, in your words, whether we should adopt a more pluralistic understanding of law's role? Can you kind of unpack that a little bit for us and tell us what you mean by that?
I just like marvel at the role that law plays in making all of this possible, I guess. And I think that it is sort of because of post-1960s developments, I think that most sort of legal progressives or legal liberals still tend to think of, you know, administrative law and administrative power as having a inequality fighting valence to it, you know, a sort of progressive tilt to it. And I guess I think that the real lesson is that, you know, there's many versions of law, and administrative implementation of law is going to look legalistic and look like the rule of law much of the time, unless it's really sloppily done, you know,
we do see instances of that, of course. But, you know, if it's well done and well reasoned, you know, all sorts of outcomes can be justified and look like law. And so it takes us back to, like, questions about, like, was Nazi law law? Is, you know, thinking about I've started to kind of dip my toe a little bit into, like, learning more about the way apartheid was constructed kind of as a legal administrative matter in South Africa. But, you know, these regimes take a lot of state power and a lot of law, and they look – they have all the trappings of legitimacy in some formal sense, but are entirely against what we hopefully understand as the ultimate ends of the Constitution and our republic. So I'm still kind of puzzling over – as, you know, probably as clear my earlier answer to what we should think about and the administrative state and how best to rein it in and how to ensure kind of any fundamental allegiance to the highest ideals of the Constitution, because it can go so easily go either way through sort of, you know, political compromise and practical lawyering tools.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, fascinating to hear this kind of counter narrative of the administrative state being an entity that kind of creatively extends judicial precedents, because, of course, now we sit in our administrative law classrooms precisely, I think, many of us with the purpose of fighting the kind of darker tendencies that you talk about in your paper.
I think something that hadn't been drilled into me in law school was understanding the key role of agencies, whether it's the EEOC interpreting Title VII or what's now the Office for Civil Rights in the Department of Education interpreting desegregation mandates and other kind of equality mandates in the context of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. All that I kind of hadn't grasped until practice when I saw that, you know, regulatory interpretations really mattered and had been the basis, you know, for some of the landmark decisions in civil rights law. Somehow that had flown by me in law school. And so I went to that. But I also realized that there was a narrative out there in the world that was sharply critical of agencies' role in unpacking the meaning of civil rights statutes. So basically most of the effects tests that we know and are familiar with, you know, disparate impact type tests for whether racial discrimination is present came about in the statutory context because of agencies puzzling through the meaning of the civil rights statutes. They unfolded kind of out of the practical need of agencies to think, well, you know, ferreting out intentional discrimination is really difficult and subjective. And if we left that as the only way of understanding discrimination, we wouldn't be able to accomplish our work of dismantling, you know, the Jim Crow regime. But there'd been this narrative that that was illegitimate, that in fact such outcome-based readings of the civil rights statutes were unelected bureaucrats catering to clientele, you know, that it was a case of capture, that civil rights organizations had actually captured agencies like the EEOC and bent them to their will, and that they were all defying the democratic mandate of Congress in enacting the civil rights statutes, which supposedly had wanted only sort of a version of anti-discrimination law that would include color blindness and bars on intentional discrimination, but otherwise wouldn't subscribe to any mandate about the substantive outcomes in terms of racial equality that should ensue. So this is like basically Hugh Davis Graham's kind of frame for his super influential book, The Civil Rights Era. So I went into the archives thinking, well, that just doesn't sound like quite the right understanding of what happened, but I'd like to see what happened post-1960s in these agencies. But then I started, you know, I started flipping through legal memos about almost anything, really, looking for material, and they weren't filed in any understandable way, and happened to come across memos about Brown, right? In June 1954, someone saying, well, there's this Brown decision, you know, an agency lawyer writing like, Brown has come down. Does it, you know, mean anything for how we fund segregation? So it kind of unfolded there.
What would you say was the most surprising finding from your research?
I really just hadn't, because it, partly, I suppose, because I was focused on the post-1960s era, you know, so the whole having a project that's about, you know, what bureaucrats were saying about anti-discrimination law pre-1960s sort of surprised me. I just hadn't realized that they would be so – that it would all be there on paper in the form of recognizable kind of legal memos being traded back and forth. It's a bit naive, but I just wouldn't have thought, you know, let me sit down and predict how, you know, policy around things like segregation would be shaped in agencies in this era. I would have sort of, I suppose, imagined that – you know, silence or you know, putting heads in the sand would have been the approach, not realizing that because my imagination, like all of ours, has been so shaped by, you know, the post-Brown, post-civil rights era, I just wouldn't have realized how easy it would be to write legal memos that justified, you know, funding de jure segregation.
And, you know, you mentioned that this article is part of a larger project, and we know in subsidizing segregation, you wrote about segregation in the education context. How do these two projects kind of relate to each other?
You know, much of my thinking, and unfortunately it's sort of probably implicitly woven into the articles in ways that aren't clear unless you read both and shape them side by side, is that they make a really interesting, you know, pair of contrasts. In education, when you come to it, there's this long narrative about, you know, the common school, the local school, like, you know, sort of this like core place for local democracy, local self-governance to play out in American history. And, you know, the sort of local common school, public school didn't exist everywhere in America, even in the early 20th century. But it's not a total fiction, of course. And so the sort of ongoing political fight over whether the federal government would have a more active role in education and whether that would mean federal enforcement of the 14th Amendment and anti-discrimination principles at the local level, the sort of pushback about kind of local control and local governments had a flavor of truth to it in that the local school really was a real institution. What I found so interesting when I then moved to housing was that a similar narrative was created, but it was much more of a fiction in housing, especially for public housing. Public housing, you know, existed nowhere until the 1930s. In some sense, we could say that, you know, the state and local police power by, you know, definition should extend to things like housing. But there really wasn't like an institution in the same way of the local school, of local public housing. But nonetheless, like such an institution was created through like strong-handed federal intervention, telling the states to write laws that would create a whole new entity, the public housing authority at the local level. And this came about, and then we have this new narrative of local control to push back against federal intervention. But, you know, I think that in the end, they really are they played out in different ways. But in the end, they're still just illustrations of these fundamental conflicts that have shaped so much of U.S. history, and particularly the 20th and 21st centuries, which is the conflict over whether we will or won't have a generous set of redistributive social policies through a central government, and the ways in which race has been interwoven through, you know, through that conflict throughout. It's a depressing story, to be honest with you.
But a great reflection to end on. This was really wonderful. Thank you so much, Professor Milligan, for being with us.
Yeah, thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's really fun to talk about it, even when it is a tad depressing.
The Yale Law Journal podcast is a production of the Yale Law Journal. Thanks to Ryan McAvoy and the wonderful folks at the Yale Broadcast Studio for making this production possible. If you like the show, don't forget to share it and give us a rating wherever you get your podcasts.